But it's a brave new world. So that's my little two cents, and if anyone else has any comments about this, please feel free. Gosh, no one else has any comments about Moore's Law? You know, it's rather important. It's the thing that that sort of predicted the incredible improvement technologically and cost-wise of all these electronic toys that we like to play with, especially computers and phones and all kinds of fun stuff, even occasionally a radio. Well, AC2IS, I guess no one else wants to play this particular game.
I guess, did you hear my follow-up query, AC2IS?
No, I did not. What was it?
I guess I was trying to transmit while, you know, the majority of that time you were transmitting. But the follow-up query was, do we know how many atoms there are in this 7-nanometer channel?
Yes, science knows. Unfortunately, I don't recall, but there are nice little images that you can Google of electron micrographs of crystal lattices where they line up, and people know exactly how much silicon takes up. They needed to know that when they were calculating Avogadro's number as the new standard, because they had to take the measured volume of the sphere that they made, and they needed the dimensions of the crystal lattice. So someone somewhere, or probably a lot of people, know exactly how many atoms it takes on the crystal lattice to line up to 7 nanometers. Unfortunately, I don't recall it right now. Any other questions or comments before I move on to the next one? It's a little micro-puzzle. Okay, I have a short piece on some new discoveries regarding Saturn. But before that, perhaps we have time for just a little puzzler. I was just wondering if anyone has any opinions or thoughts or what have you on what makes up most of the rings of Saturn. Anyone have any guesses of what an incredible percentage of the rings of Saturn are made of? Say again?
WP2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
Rings of Saturn are made up of ice crystals.
Yes, indeed. Give that man a gold star. It's almost 99% ice. There's some dry ice, a lot of water ice, but it's basically ice. It's highly reflective, and it's not really rings, if you think about it, and if you look enough, they're actually rather tight spirals. The same forces that cause galaxies to form spirals also are forming the very tight spirals of Saturn. So, you know, it would be probably a little bit more accurate to call them the tight spirals of Saturn rather than rings, but no one's going to change their ways.
Those rings are in a pretty hard vacuum of space. Water ice usually sublimes, turns directly into a gas when it's in a vacuum. You would think, therefore, those rings would be dissipating. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Oh, yeah, and like all things are transitory, and my next little story is about the apparent age and life expectancy of Saturn's rings.
AC2IS query.
Yes, AC2IS.
Seeing the fact that these are spirals implies that these were large objects, larger chunks of ice at one point, and that, you know, tidal forces or the equivalent of tidal forces fractured them and broke them down into smaller and smaller pieces, and they fanned out into spirals in that way, which would mean to me that probably they're getting small enough at some point where these tidal forces are not strong enough to break them anymore, and they're not likely to sublimate from those forces, but maybe, you know, the sun or something else could impart energy to them that would cause them to sublimate. AC2IS.
GXM. WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich. Go ahead.
In fact, it has been pointed out on the Discovery Channel that are in fact not permanent. They, at one point in the past, they were not there, and at some point in the future, they will not be there again. Or they may even come back millennia from now. WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich, you basically read ahead of my next little story. Okay, Saturn's rings might have formed relatively recently, like in the past 100 million years or so, according to new research. A team of scientists analyzed Saturn's gravitational field and the mass of its rings based on data from the Cassini mission, which ended in 2017. And measurements led to insights about the planet's composition and the ring's young age, at least from an astronomical standpoint. Scientists assessed Saturn's gravitational field during a microwave signal that Cassini sent to the receivers on Earth during its grand finale orbit. During these 22 grand finale orbits, the spacecraft was positioned such that it would raise Saturn's cloud tops on each pass and send its signal to Earth without being blocked by Saturn. The researchers picked six of these orbits, measuring how the gravitational field around Saturn changed Cassini's velocity and, in turn, the microwave signal. Let me drop for a second. After inferring the strength of the gravitational field from the planet and its rings, the researchers were able to pick out the ring's total mass, about 15 quintillion kilograms. That's about 7,000 times less massive than Earth's moon, or about 0.4 times the mass of the small Saturnian moon Mimas. The team estimated the ring's age at about 10 million to 100 million years old, compared to the planet's age of 4.5 billion years, as they published results in the magazine Science. The young age of the rings has important implications. It means that the features that we most identify with Saturn might be a new thing, cosmologically speaking, possibly the result of some chaotic collision that occurred millions of years ago, or maybe something stranger, and combined with recent data suggests that the planet's rings might be gone in another 100 million years. We're lucky to live in an age Saturn has rings. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
One of the rings is constantly being replenished. There's a moon called Enceladus around Saturn, and Cassini discovered that it was blowing off plenty of water, ice, every now and then, and that was adding to the ring system. So that's one thing it found, and one of the future missions, they plan on duplicating one of the orbits that go very close to Enceladus, and this time they're going to have more detectors and try to figure out what's involved in that spray that's coming off Enceladus. Maybe there's some kinds of evidence of life deep inside that moon. But meanwhile, that spray that's going up hundreds of miles into the atmosphere is escaping from the moon, and a lot of it's winding up as a part of a ring system. Back to you, Roy. WS1.
Thanks, Paul. That's very interesting. Well, you know, like I said before, unfortunately, nothing is simple when it comes to science. There's always much more complex physical systems going on, interacting with each other. And way back when we talked about Io, there was some talk about whether it was close enough to be ripped apart by the forces, gravitational forces of the planet. So probably something akin to that, not as big as Io, certainly minuscule when it comes in comparison, came a little too close to Saturn, got ripped to pieces for its trouble. And I guess it does make a very pretty appearance. Historically, it sort of drove Galileo a little crazy because his telescope wasn't capable of resolving the details of Saturn. And so depending upon at what inclination the Earth was to Saturn, and so the ring kind of was a different angle, it looked like Saturn had bunny ears at one point, and it had no rings in another point, and it was very changeable. It was only about, I think, 50 or 75 years later, Huygens kind of perfected a telescope and improved the resolution that they were actually able to realize that it was rings going on causing that effect. Any other comments or questions, or we'll move on to the next story.
GXM.
Yes, Rich.
Roy, I apologize for breaking into you this train of thought. I've been watching the news. They are saying that the lunar eclipse will start at 10:35 p.m. and totalitarian, whatever that is, will be at 11:41 p.m. WB2JSM.
Okay, no problem, Rich. If anyone wants to go out and look at the moon, or wouldn't it be nicer if you put your radio near a place that had a nice window and you could stay nice and warm and look out at the moon?
That's WPG with info.
That's what I've been doing, WS2, and I can look out the window and see it. I heard another station. I jumped on it. WS2.
Yeah, and I think they call it totality. What's your comment, the other station?
It's N2APG. WABC has a live stream of the eclipse online, so you can stay inside, listen and participate in the net, and watch the eclipse on your device. Name is Dave.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. That's excellent. And if people so inclined, I'm sure the video will be available afterwards, and you can play it as many times as you'd like and simulate multiple eclipses. Okay, any other comments before I move on? Okay, very well. And talking about the days of the dinosaurs, something just as amazing might have been happening right here on Mother Earth around the same exact time. By comparing the age of impact craters on the moon to those on Earth, researchers say they have discovered a surge in the rate of asteroid strikes starting around 290 million years ago, a finding that runs contrary to scientific convention. And indeed, not everyone is convinced by this evidence. Scientists who study ancient impact craters on Earth have a problem. Erosion, weathering, volcanism, tectonics, and other geological processes have swept away the traces of our planet's oldest impact craters, making it difficult to chronicle the history of asteroid impact on Earth. New research published recently in Science suggests that the moon and its extensive collection of impact craters can help. As neighbors, the Earth and the Moon have experienced similar rates of asteroid strikes over the course of the solar system's history. But the Moon, unlike Earth, isn't subject to the same erosional processes. Consequently, the Moon's surface has retained a long-term record of its impact history. If these lunar craters can be dated, then it should be possible to recreate the historical bombardment rates on Earth. Let me drop for a second. By using a new technique to date lunar craters from a distance, a research team was able to accomplish exactly this. The technique allowed them to date lunar craters with diameters greater than 6 miles and younger than 1 billion years. This exercise yielded two important findings, both of which challenge conventional notions of Earth's impact record. The first is that the impact rate on Earth increased by a factor of 2.6, or between 2 and 3 times. About 290 million ago, at the end of the Paleozoic era, and just talking about it theorized Snowball Earth, a time when most, if not all, of our planet was coated in a thick layer of ice. Let me drop for a second. The idea that the frequency of impacts on the moon and the Earth has jumped since 290 million years ago goes against conventional thinking. Theoretically, the rate of asteroid strikes should be decreasing, not increasing, as the debris left over from the formation of the solar system gradually dissipates. The authors of the new study are presenting a big claim, one requiring the requisite big evidence, and indeed, some of the experts aren't entirely convinced by the new paper, saying it relied on too many assumptions. The methods aren't persuasive enough, and that more evidence is needed to back the claim. To date, the lunar craters, the team used thermal data and images collected by NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, a device on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter called the Diviner, provided this data by measuring the heat radiating from the moon's surface. At night, large rocks give off more heat than fine soil, allowing the Diviner to do its work. And it just so happens that young craters on the moon are surrounded by large rocks. When a crater is formed after an impact, it excavates a lot of rocks. The rocks around the crater eventually turn into regoliths, or lunar sand, due to further micrometeorite bombardment. This process takes about 1 billion years. As a crater becomes older, they become less rocky, and they use this relationship to get to the age of lunar craters. Drop for a second. With this technique, the researchers were able to compile the ages of all lunar craters, younger than around a billion years, a rather time-consuming process, to be sure. As noted, the team correlated the age of the lunar impact craters with those on Earth. The common belief among scientists is that many of Earth's craters have been wiped away by geological processes. But by comparing the lunar craters to the ones, they showed that for very large craters, those bigger than 12 miles in diameter and younger than 650 million years, a complete record of terrestrial impact craters does in fact exist. To be clear, however, this only applies to craters found on stable terrains, excluding areas like the ocean, the Amazon, and so on. Analysis of this data exposed the frequency spike in impacts starting around 290 million years ago, but it yielded other interesting findings. Let me drop for a second. By reassessing the terrestrial impact records, the researchers discovered a dearth of craters on between 300 million and 650 million years ago during the Precambrian era. This surprising deficit of craters, according to the study, is not of erosion, but rather an unexpected decline in asteroid impacts during its historical period. The data showed a dramatic cutoff in the number of terrestrial craters around 650 million years ago, during the Precambrian era. This is a surprise, but as the authors wrote in the study, there's a possible explanation. Given erosion rates on stable continental terrains after 650 million years, similar conditions further back in time would have allowed most craters of the Precambrian age to survive. Instead, the paucity of Precambrian craters is coincident with the major episodes of global extensive noble Earth glaciation. Pervasive subglacial erosion at approximately 650 to 720 million years is thought to have removed kilometers of material from the continents, enough to erase most existing impact craters. Let me drop for a second. It's a fascinating possibility and further evidence in favor of the burgeoning snowball Earth hypothesis that crater formations over the past 290 million years is 2 to 3 times higher than it was before the time of the dinosaurs is surprising, but the team offered a plausible explanation. The increase in the impact rate might be due to a large breakup event in the main asteroid belt. When two large asteroids collide, they produce a swarm of fragments close to the impact site. These eventually move on to the Earth crossing orbit, and a few end up hitting the moon and Earth. The timing of this impact spike is quite interesting, and not just from an astronomical perspective. The apparent increase in impact may have influenced the history of our planet. One of the largest extinction events happened around 250 million years ago. the Permian-Triassic mass extinction, which occurred shortly after the observed increase in the rate of asteroid impact. This isn't the settled affair by far. Many scientists refute aspects of this study and its findings, but it's an interesting theory. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Any questions before I move on to the next one? Okay, they say the only sure thing in life are death and taxes. This next story explains why you shouldn't trust your compass all the time. Rapid and erratic movements of the Earth's North Magnetic Pole have prompted an early update to a model that assists with navigation. The Schedule 6 was supposed to happen on January 15th, but the U.S. government shutdown has forced an unwelcome delay. The magnetic North Pole is shifting at an unprecedented rate. Over the last 30 years, the rate of distance that the magnetic North Pole has moved per year has sped up around 9.3 miles per year to over 34 miles per year, according to an article in the magazine Nature. Unlike the static geographic North Pole, the North Magnetic Pole is in constant flux, influenced by the movement of iron-rich fluids deep below the Earth's crust. Or it, that's the theory. The whole thing's still somewhat of a scientific mystery to us all. Let me drop for a second. The World Magnetic Model provides a 5-year forecast of the Earth's magnetic field. It assists with navigation. But the rapid and irregular movements of the North Magnetic Pole over the past 3 years has made the 2016 World Magnetic Model inaccurate. An unprecedented early update was supposed to happen on January 15, 2019, but that's been bumped to January 30th owing to the ongoing U.S. government shutdown, as reported in Nature. The World Magnetic Model forecasts are produced by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the British Geological Survey on behalf of the U.S. NASA a year earlier than usual. For the fix, the scientists will add data to the model, making the 2016 pulse no longer solely surfacing, and there's something quite clever going on underneath. Your phone contains a magnetometer that is measuring the Earth's magnetic field. In order to make sense of this information, a reference model like the World Magnetic Model is needed to correct the measurements of north made by your phone to true north. The accuracy of a phone's compass is only as good as the World Magnetic Model. Let me drop for a second. For example, let's say you were on a boat at a distance of 1 mile from the North Magnetic Pole. The arrow on your phone compass will point directly at the magnetic north. But the corresponding map on your phone, because it's referencing an inaccurate forecast of where the magnetic north should be, will likely give you a false impression of where you are on the planet. And given the degree to which the magnetic North Pole is moving each year, the map could really be off. It's important to point out that the farther you are from the North Magnetic Pole, the less of an issue this becomes. The rapid movement of the North Magnetic Pole makes navigational systems in the Arctic more prone to large errors. Unless you live way up north or work for any of the defense agencies listed earlier, you're likely to have nothing to worry about. The compasses in our smartphone will only be fractionally wrong and within errors allowed in the 5-year model. Let me drop for a second. Regardless, it'll be good to get an accurate World Magnetic Model in place as soon as possible. The North Magnetic Pole shifts around 2 to 3 miles each month in the general direction of Siberia, if anyone's curious. Well, some more proof that the government does provide useful services when it's funded. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
DDH with a question.
Yes, John.
The eclipse has actually started.
I was just wondering, are there corresponding movements in the South Magnetic Pole maintain the 180 degree difference as a true magnet should, or because the magnetic field is generated by the iron core rotating, are there some misalignments between the North and South Magnetic Poles? Go ahead.
Well, once again, it's my understanding that things are way complicated. It's not a simple bar magnet spinning around. You have a perfect north on one side, south on the other side. One historical indication is that every so often the magnetic poles flip-flop in the opposite direction. All bets are off, and there's probably some fluctuation going on towards the South Pole as well. It's, science is complicated, unfortunately. Any other questions or comments on the subject? Very well. You've heard of binary star systems. They're very, very common. Perhaps you've heard of trinary star systems. But this may possibly be the first time that you've heard about a quaternary star system. Even so, you probably never heard about one quite like this one. Astronomers using the ALM telescope have discovered an oddly tilted planet-forming disk within a double binary star system, a configuration that up until this point only existed in our series. Quadruple star systems featuring two binary pairs are nothing unusual, nor is the discovery of a surrounding protoplanetary disk. A ring of gas and dust that gradually congeals to form planets. A star system located 146 light years from Earth, called HD98800, has all of these things, but as new research published recently in Nature Astronomy reveals, this system features an exceptionally strange protoplanetary disk. Let me stop for a second. HD98800 features an inner binary pair of stars and an outer pair. The pair on the inside, called BABB, are in close proximity to each other, around one astronomical unit, which is the average distance from the Earth to the Sun. Its outer pair, called AAAB, is much further out, at 54 astronomical units, a much greater distance than the stretch between Pluto and the Sun. Never mind the outer pair, it's the inner pair and its surrounding disks that are particularly interesting. Let me drop for a second. Normally, a protoplanetary disk rests along the same plane as the orbital plane of its binary star host, but not HD98800. Its protoplanetary disk rests perpendicular to the plane of the binary pair at a right angle. It's in a polar configuration where, instead of running east-west, the disk is running north-south, so to speak. Here's another analogy. The inner binary pair are like two horses going around on a carousel, while the protoplanetary disk is like a giant Ferris wheel with the carousel at its center. Prior to this finding, systems such as HD98800 only existed in theory. Astronomers have known about HD98800 for several years. Previously, scientists have tracked the motion of its inner stars to see how they moved in relation to each other. Now, using the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, a team was able to visually... One sec. Let me drop for a sec. A team was able to visually inspect the system and characterize the orientation of the protoplanetary ring surrounding the inner binary pair. Fascinatingly, and despite this odd configuration, HD98800 still exhibits characteristics consistent with early planetary formation. We take this to mean planetary formation can at least get started in these polar circumbinary disks, explained one of the writers of the research paper. If the rest of the planet's formation process can happen, there might be a whole population of misaligned circumbinary planets that we have yet to discover and things like weird seasonal variations to consider. But while planetary formations can get started, it's not clear the degree to which planets can form and remain stable within such a seemingly chaotic system. Should planets or planetismals exist, however, however, the view from one object within such a system would be extraordinary. Standing on one of these planetesimals, you would see the protoplanetary disk extending out from the horizon, reaching directly overhead, and returning to the horizon behind you. Meanwhile, at a spot along the disk, two stars would be seen moving back and forth around the protoplanetary disk. Let me drop for a second. Configurations of this type are exactly what one would expect from the interplay between gravity and internal dissipation within protoplanetary disks. The discovery of such systems suggests that the modeling efforts were essentially spot on. Without a doubt, much more such systems will be discovered in the future. It's a funny mathematical quirk of orbital dynamics that polar orbits around binary star systems are very stable configurations. But it wasn't clear whether nature would ever form them there in the first place. There have been several previous examples of highly inclined disks, but this is the first slam dunk case and a real testament to the author's careful work and the new ALMA Observatory's fantastic technical capabilities. The next challenge will be for astronomers to identify similar systems and at different stages in their development. The discovery of actual planets within such a system would be particularly mind-blowing. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Query.
Query away. Yes, someone said they had a query. One last time. Anyone have any particular questions about this, or should I move on to the next?
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Are the outer two stars and the inner binary stars, are they all orbiting one common barycenter? Do all four stars have a common barycenter? Go ahead.
Yes, that's my understanding of the way it's arranged.
Be okay, thanks.
Okay, I mean, it's one of those cases where strange science gives you equations that suggest that very strange things can be stable, and sure enough, if you keep looking, you're actually going to find them out there. So, another reason science is such an amazing thing to me personally. Any other questions or comments before I move on to the next one? We're going to talk about a brand new collider. Everyone's kind of looking forward to a new collider. So the next story is, unless anyone has any questions. Okay, very well. Are you growing a bit jaded about that puny little Large Hadron Collider? You want something a wee bit grander? Well, CERN has something you might be interested in if you have the time. Money. A scientific collaboration has released a concept design for the Large Hadron Collider's successor, an enormous new experiment that would sit inside a 62-mile tunnel. The design concept plans for the two future circular colliders, the first of which would begin operation perhaps in 2040. The ambitious experiment would hunt for new particles with collision velocities 10 times higher than those created by the Large Hadron Collider. The concept design is the first big milestone achieved by the scientific collaboration. Particle colliders accelerate tiny bits of matter to velocities close to the speed of light, slamming them together. Since energy and mass are equivalent in physics, new particles might materialize out of that collision. High energies also allow physicists to take measurements of realms impossible to probe in the typical lab. Larger colliders typically let physicists explore the kinds of particles that fill the universe at times closer and closer to the Big Bang. Let me drop for a second. The Large Hadron Collider discovered the Higgs boson, the last particle predicted by particle physics rulebook, the standard model. But There are still, there still appears to be missing mass in the universe in the form of dark matter, whatever the heck that is. And there are other unsolved physical mysteries that might require more energy than the Large Hadron Collider can provide, hence the need for a bigger atom smasher. The Future Circular Collider's news report offers designs for a 62-mile round tunnel with access points BDC and around Geneva, Switzerland, which would cost about $5.7 billion. A $4 billion machine that collides electrons and their antimatter partner, a positron, would occupy the space at first. Then perhaps a decade or two later, it would be replaced with a proton or atom colliding machine akin to the Large Hadron Collider. The Large Hadron Collider's own 16-mile round tunnel was at first home to the Large Electron-Positron Collider. Let me drop for a second. Some particle physicists are enthusiastic about the possibility of discovering new physical phenomena to explain outstanding mysteries. They are excited because the newly proposed collider would allow scientists to study the Higgs boson to a factor of 20 to 50 times the present precision. It might be sensitive to possible new particles, if they exist, even if they are too massive to be made by current accelerators or only directly show up as small changes in the standard model. But there are still some uncertainties about the future circular collider will actually tell us. Some scientists believe that after the discovery of the Higgs boson, there is no good reason for why there should be anything else to find, either at the Large Hadron Collider nor at higher energies, not up until 50 orders of magnitude higher than what we can reach. Some scientists think that it might require building a particle accelerator around Mars or even around the entire solar system to actually answer physicists' thesis questions. How would you like the bill for that? You might also note that China has released plans for its own 62-mile collider. The future is going to be curious out there. So, this is, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, they're always looking to solve this supersymmetry problem. You know, everything is supposed to have, an equal and opposite. And they're always looking for that. And I wonder if this is one of the goals of the 62-mile collider. And what's magical about the 62? I know this one that we have is 17 miles at CERN. Why are they picking 62? Back to you.
Well, it's a combination of things. Number one, we're Homo sapiens. We have 10 hands and 10 feet. And those guys in Geneva think in terms of the metric. So they don't think in terms of the 62-mile collider. They call it the 100-kilometer collider.
Oh, okay. But, why not 200? They're picking a number. I wonder what the idea of that is. That makes sense. And how about supersymmetry? Did they mention that at all?
Supersymmetry is a real sore spot with physicists. A lot of them believe in it. A bunch don't believe in it. A lot of them really thought seriously that after the Higgs boson was discovered in the Large Hadron Collider, that supersymmetrical particles would come rather quickly, and they didn't. We've already kind of passed the threshold of some theoretical constructs of the mass energy of some supersymmetrical particles, and we haven't seen any of them. So it's upsetting to a lot of people, but part of what's going on in the back of their head is that they really, really, really want to find those supersymmetry particles because they sort of needed to develop something that makes sense in terms of quantum gravity. The concept of supersymmetry is kind of difficult to explain. The concept is that there are two types of particles in the world. Energy-containing particles called bosons and what we consider mass particles, fermions. And supersymmetry suggests that there are mirror images. There are all the electrons and protons, all the fermions have an equivalent boson, and all the bosons, like the gluon of the strong force or boson, or W bosons and such, have a symmetrical fermion. These things are incredibly heavy, incredibly unstable, and require enormous energy to create them if they aren't just theoretical but real. So in the short term, Paul, yeah, in the back of their head, they really want to prove supersymmetry. It's the next big step as they see it. And it beats building a collider around the solar system.
Very good.
Okay.
Well, at least somebody's doing it. We were supposed to have one. I think it was going to be 50 miles many, many years ago down in Texas, but they canceled that. So, okay. I know, the bigger the better for these things. I'll let you continue, Roy. WS-Twin.
Okay, as the thing goes, you snooze, you lose. So we almost had it, and then we got chicken. Let me do a quick rendition of something that goes hand in hand with this, and then we'll move on to Paul's space report. What proposed Chinese 62-mile collider, you might ask? Well, let me tell you about this one. Scientists this past November released a conceptual design report for a next-generation particle accelerator in China, of all places, which would serve as a Higgs boson factory, as its proponents have called it. Back in 2012, the Large Hadron Collider, as I said before, discovered the Higgs boson particle, which netted Englert and Higgs the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physics. A next-generation collider would lots of those Higgs bosons. In order to understand the generation collider, would make the particle properties and help scientists decide the future direction of particle physics. Some have commented that simply embracing the accelerator could be ignoring the human rights abuses of the Chinese government and the country's political climate. Physicists rely on particle accelerators to understand matter's constituent parts. Sending a subatomic particle to almost the speed of light and then smashing them together turns all of that energy into mass and produces particles visible to the collider's detector. These high energies would potentially recreate some of the conditions at just after the Big Bang and answer questions about particles that make up the universe, the force of gravity, and tons of other things. Let me drop for a second. The current largest collider is the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, which smashes protons and has a circumference of 16 miles. But scientists have already begun planning the successor. CERN is in the midst of upgrading the Large Hadron Collider and, as I said before, has plans for the future circular collider. Recently, the consortium of scientists representing the Chinese Circular Electron Positron released a report detailing their proposed collider. It, too, would be housed in a 62-mile round tunnel at one of three potential sites. The document works under the assumption that the colliders will be located near something called Quanhongdao City, around 200 miles east of Peking, and it would collide electrons with their antimatter partners called positrons. It would serve to generate more than 1 million Higgs bosons, as well as billions of other particles called Z bosons and 15 million pairs of W bosons. This would allow scientists to precisely particles, which could direct physicists towards the kind of experiments they should perform next. It's in the line with goals of other proposed future particle colliders, like the International Linear Collider that would live in Japan. Let me drop for a second. The tunnel is also large enough to accommodate a proton accelerator in the future to complete higher energy proton collisions like those at the Large Hadron Collider, but on a larger scale. The tunnel could also serve as a synchrotron, another kind of particle accelerator that generates bright light to use for things like microscopy. There is some concern with this project. They've applauded the efforts of the young scientists who put together the report, as well as the international collaboration, but said we all must consider the implications beyond just physics. Critics of the project are concerned both with effects of the experiment and safety of the construction project. They cite that the Chinese government displaced 9,000 villagers to fast telescope, and it's been safety issues related to construction of its high-speed rail network. Research and development on the project will begin from 2018 to 2022. According to the report, the Chinese funding agencies have an interest in funding large science projects. Construction would then run from 2022 to 2030. After 10 years of operation, the upgrade to a proton collider would begin. All in all, proposals for the project estimate a cost of less than $5.92 billion and mentions that building in China would lead to forced space. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, very good. So the moral of the story is that if we make it to 2040, there's going to be a lot more big collider toys to play with. As always, I appreciate all the participation tonight, and I hope to find some clever puzzles for next week. Wish me luck. If you have any topics, if you have any puzzles, if you have anything that you want to tell me, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I will post links to all of these articles, the fascinating YouTube that shows acoustic impedance and causing reflection of waves and such, very fascinating, and even a link to an electrical engineering group that take apart and don't put back together the Zenik wave theory. But, you know, it's good to have a dream. Anyway, this is AC2GS Roy, and thanks, and I will send it off back to Dick so that he can send it to Paul.
Good stuff, Roy. Thank you very much. Nice, attractive subjects. This signal was a tiny bit noisy tonight. In other words, a little bit of crackly's in there, but I think that's because of the way the antenna's behaving on this super cold night, the repeater antenna. And of your long list that you mailed me, you went through almost all of them, at least on the first page. Good job. Paul, WS2N, what's NASA doing that we should know about? When's the next launch? WS2N, K2RAW, you got a call with the Space Report.
This is WS2N for the Space Net Report. And I would have to say I'm waiting for the ICON mission, maybe. That's probably the earliest February. Have a launch from Russia with three astronauts on board going to the space station. Right now there's three on the space station. That will bring us up to six. But I think a lot of the work is being cut back. NASA's on the list for government shutdown, so anything that's ongoing, like, you know, the Mars rovers, you know, they'll keep going. The planetary missions, there's 16 of them, they'll keep monitoring through the deep space network. But anything new right now, I think, is a little problematic. But we cover the world anyway, so plenty of launches worldwide. Just 2 days ago, NASA, but the military needed to get a spy satellite up there, you know, so the NRO is launched by NRO, National Reconnaissance Laboratory, But nevertheless, they launched a Delta IV Heavy from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And that was pretty impressive. And I would like that. And that's around maybe 2.5 million pounds of thrust. A little bit less than that. Each booster delivers, I think, 710,000 pounds. So it's three boosters bolted together. They go up and support, and the soft side separates. The core continues on. And that's by United Launch Alliance. Well, but that has nothing to do with NASA, so that's why that kept on going. By the way, about 5 minutes before before I finished. Look at the moon. Looks like it's almost half gone. Interesting. Try to take a picture with my tablet. We'll see how that comes out. And let's see, I did have a question for Roy. I don't know if you read it. I sent it over as an email earlier, a couple of hours ago. Roy, did you get the question dealing with the crystals, the antioxidant protein thing that I sent you? Or do you want to wait until next week on that?
Yeah, Paul, I got it, but we can talk about it tonight if you want.
Yeah, I'm curious, because if that works, you know, it would help astronauts go on to long-term flight, to Mars. You know, you'd be able to, it would help with the radiation that they're going to incur on the same-month journey. And what they're doing on the International Space Station is taking this protein, this antioxidant protein, magnesium, superoxide, and I can't pronounce this word, dismutase, D-I-S-M-U-T-A-S-V. Don't know what all of that is, but they're working on that, creating a better protein out of this stuff on the space station, because they can do it up there. They can't do it as good on Earth. And whatever this stuff is, apparently it helps to prevent getting radiation. It also possibly might be not a cure, but help people with cancer. So if this stuff works out, you know, I mean, they should mass produce it. You know, I would have a space station up there just to mass produce this stuff and, you know, give to everybody on Earth. But my question is, do you really think this would work, or have you read anything about this particular, I'm going to call it a supplement, to help people not get radiation? You know, you got 8 months to Mars, a year on Mars, another 8 months back, you know. So you're probably going to be glowing by the time you get back. Back to you, Roy, H-E-2-G-S-W-S-2-N.
Well, Paul, I hate to burst anyone's balloon, but it's not going to be a practical supplement, although you can go on the Internet today, tonight, and order a bottle of supposedly the stuff. There's a whole bunch of problems. What this stuff does is it's one of the many class of so-called antioxidants in your mitochondria. A lot of radical oxygen is produced in order to do metabolism and synthesis, and if it goes crazy and escapes, it wreaks havoc. So your body also produces antioxidants, mostly in the mitochondria, to kind of limit that activity. They found that gene expression higher for this protein can correlate with lower risk of cancer and radiation problems. But you can't simply swallow it because you can't get it from your gut to your mitochondria. So the thing that NASA is really doing is just crystallizing more perfect crystals in low gravity and shipping them back so that they could do X-ray spectrometry and neutron spectroscopy and figure out the structure better so that they can figure out how it works so that they could reverse engineer something that would work in the same way. So it's not quite the panacea, and no one's going to be pumping out a lot of this mutation. They like what it does, and they want to see if they can somehow scam our body into using something else and being so just as useful in that way.
Okay. Yeah, I was getting my hopes up, not only for long trips to Mars, but, you know, they did talk about it as maybe help prevent some kinds of cancer on Earth, so that would have been good. And it did come from a NASA site, so it wasn't, you know, some phony baloney website that I got it from. So it looks like my hopes are starting to diminish. Looks like they have a long way to go in doing something like this. That's the biggest problem. you know, get, you know, there's all kinds of problems getting to Mars, but one of the biggest problems is radiation. And for now, they think that they can take, well, they're going to need plenty of water to get to Mars. And they can take these water bags and point them in the direction of the sun. And they, you know, as long as they use that as a shield, that might help. But I still don't think it's good enough to do what they need to do. And then they would have to do the same thing on the planet itself. Maybe go, you know, into a cave or something to protect themselves from radiation. And then another 8 months back. So, you know, okay. I know water's a good shield. They think if they could create enough water on Mars, they could actually make a form of an igloo, you know, you actually live with inside of a frozen structure on Mars, and that would help. But I guess not. All right, Bri, thanks for that. Any comments or questions?
Just want to add something.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Bri.
Yeah, I mean, some of the studies on the Earth, they took little plasmids, injected them into cells, and basically did a little bit of hairy genetic engineering. I wonder if, I'm sure the astronauts would be gung-ho about it, but I wonder if NASA would be squirrely enough to consider genetically re-engineering their astronauts to, say, have a higher percentage of this protein in their mitochondria to make them a little bit more radiation resistant.
Okay, it sounds good. Even going to the moon, they were worried about it, you know, with the flights, you know, that we had six flights to actually land on the moon, and a couple of extra ones at 13 and 10 that didn't land on the moon. They went in and Apollo 8, so six that landed, three that went, that didn't land. But all that time going to the moon, around the moon and back, you know, they're pretty much exposed, and they were kind of worried about that. And I don't think too many of them wound up with cancer in their later life. So maybe they did okay with those really two or three, actually, 2.5 week flights to and from the moon. Any other comments, Roy?
Well, I mean, just that a couple of weeks is one thing. As you mentioned, these trips to Mars is going to be a long affair, and there'll be absolutely nothing to protect them from the radiation out in space except for the shell around them, and I don't know how much water that they can carry and shield themselves. So it's one of the many problems: gravity, radiation, and resources. Having something with incredible energy density that they can bring along and supply a lot of things. There isn't that much that you could make energy from readily available on the surface of Mars, but I don't know. I'm not as sanguine as the possibility of anything in the recent future of someone actually going there. I think it's going to be a bunch of robots for a long, long time.
Yeah, I could, well, we got from there at least five orbiting spacecraft around Mars so far. Right now, one functioning robot riding around on Mars called Curiosity. They haven't got an opportunity back online yet, and I don't know, they might eventually give up hope that that's the one that they lost power. All power completely disappeared from the dust storm that they had on Mars. It never recovered after the dust storm went away. It just never recovered. They were hoping that it would. They keep their fingers crossed, and they keep looking for a signal. Nothing yet. That was back in October. They lost the signal with that. Now, talking about the Mars program, there's SpaceX. That's Elon Musk. And his goal is still to get to Mars. And he's now in the process of building what he calls the Starship and the Super Heavy. Starship is like the second stage of the Super Heavy booster. down in Boca Chica, Texas. They're still going to build the engines in California and ship the engines to Texas. The spacecraft itself is so large, 30 feet in diameter, you know, hundreds of feet high. Incredible. Big, you know, something, the final version would be like taller than or equal to with the Saturn V. And I believe the Saturn V is 343 feet high.